Good morning, everyone. I call this meeting of the Human Services Policy Committee to order. Members, please take your seats. Thank you all for being here. A few notes before we get started. As I'm sure everyone can tell, that I am not Chair Fisher. But I do want to share that earlier this week, Chair Fisher suffered a heart attack. And he is treated. His doctors expect that he will make a full recovery. And he wanted to thank everyone who reached out since that happened. This hearing will be informational only, and no action will be taken at this meeting. I want to welcome members from the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee who were invited to participate in this meeting, as these rates primarily fall under their fiscal jurisdiction, while we will be seeing bills related to all aspects of behavioral health policy. I also want to note that we are testing out some new remote participation technology today. Representative Hicks and Baker will be participating remotely, and other committees will likely use this technology similar to how it operates in Capital 120. Any questions or comments from members on any of these items? Seeing none, we will now turn to the Department of Human Services to present the results of their rates study. Giogo Hase, Director of Health Improvement and Benefits Design Division, Minnesota Department of Human Services. Please state your name when you're ready and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As you mentioned, Giogo Hase, excellent pronunciation, by the way, currently serving as the Director of the Health Improvement and Benefit Design Division at the Department of Human Services. I'm here with my colleague, Ms. Grum, who will also help with the presentation today. As we get started, just want to say at the outset, thank you for the opportunity to come and talk about this outpatient rate study, something that I know you all and we have been very interested in working on. We are going to dive into some significant detail related to the rate study, how the methodologies work, look at some numbers, that sort of thing. But I just wanted to level set to make sure that we communicate that. Obviously, this is a means to an end. Rates are a means to an end. And the end is certainly to ensure that members have access to services. And so that's what the spirit in which we approach the work here. So despite all the details and the numbers and the minutiae that we're going to talk a little bit about here, keep in mind that that's where we are trying to get to make sure members can access services that they need and want. So with that, we'll dive right in. We embarked on a legislative outpatient rate study specific to fee-for-service rates, and obviously this doesn't include the entirety of the Medicaid rate-setting methodologies. And so this was a directive that came from the legislature in 2021, which we were happy to pursue as something that we had been interested in doing. And it focuses largely on the community-based physical health services and the community-based behavioral health services, which we'll dive into the details on. As part of this project, we issued a request for proposal where we contracted with HMA Burns, which is a consulting company that works nationwide on setting rates within the healthcare marketplace. This is a consulting firm that has experience doing these types of rates in other states and, in fact, has worked with Minnesota in the past on setting some of the rates that we use here as well. Per the legislation, there was a preliminary report that was issued in August of 2023 that sort of looked at an environmental scan of rate methodologies and the rate methodologies here in Minnesota, and then a subsequent report that was just released, which we are going to dive into the details today, that talks about some of the deficiencies perhaps that exist or areas of improvement maybe that exist in our methodologies today, as well as recommendations that we collectively could pursue. The presentation is going to largely flow into three buckets. I'm going to talk about sort of how the project went, kind of like some logistics about engagement and the project. I'm going to then talk about the physical health services, and then Ms. Grom will take over and talk about the balance of the behavioral health and some of the other services within the report. The consultant broke the services down into six buckets, which you see outlined on the slides here. So we have community-based mental health services and substance use disorder services, early intensive developmental and behavioral intervention services, often referred to as EIDBI services, psychiatric residential treatment facilities, sometimes referred to as PRTF services, behavioral health services, and physical health services. They put together several work groups, six work groups specifically, one for each one of these topics, and held more than 30 meetings across these specific work groups. Not every work group met the same amount of time. It depended on the level of engagement within the work group itself, the level of complexity within that particular methodology. And so in aggregate, there were over 30 meetings. The work groups helped inform for many of the work groups, a provider survey that went out to community providers to collect information in order to inform the rate methodology. And then the consultant also met individually with providers at their request, sometimes to provide clarity, sometimes to get additional information and to solicit as much information as possible. One thing I'll note is despite the fact that the work groups had members involved, the survey was sent to all providers serving in the Medicaid program. So it was an opportunity for any provider, even if not involved in the work group, to contribute to the surveys that were sent out and inform the recommendations of the study. As we dive towards understanding some of the recommendations, might be helpful to understand what some of the goals are or what some of the problems that maybe were identified that the survey or that the rate study, was attempting to address. And so first you'll see their cost coverage. As you might anticipate, providers obviously incur costs in order to deliver services to the members of the program. And obviously we want to do the best job that we can to make sure that we're covering the inputs that they're using in order to make it financially sustainable for them. That's obviously directly related to the end that I mentioned before, to make sure that members can access the services that they need. One of the issues, the second there on the screen there, you'll see static methodologies. And so that's referring to the fact that many of our methodologies over time are not able to be manipulated or changed by the department because the legislation, the enacting legislation is very prescriptive on sort of the equation. I often, on Saturday night parties when people ask me what I do for a living, I always talk about it's kind of like a junior high math problem that's in the statute and we do the math, right? And the junior high math problem, if you will, doesn't allow us to make a lot of tweaks and sometimes results in static methodologies that don't account for inflation, don't account necessarily for changes in the healthcare marketplace, for the employment marketplace. And so one of the goals of these recommendations is really to allow for methodologies that are a little bit more responsive to the changes in the landscape within reason, obviously. The last two I'll speak to kind of together at the same time here. So inconsistency in the rate methodologies and some lack of transparency that exists in the methodologies. This has to do a lot with some of the changes that we've made over the years to account for some of the deficits of our methodologies in order to sort of kind of fix problems that arise over time when we aren't able to be as nimble as we like to be. So some examples of those are sort of some rate increases and decreases that apply over time in order to address problems but result in some significant complexity, which we'll show some examples of. It also results in some lack of transparency for providers in understanding what they get paid for and how much they get paid. And again, I'll show some examples of those as well. Going a little further into the detail, wanted to just make sure we talked about what's in scope of this particular rate study and what is out of scope. As I mentioned at the outset, this does not attempt to tackle every single rate methodology that we use in the fee-for-service Medicaid program, but rather specific the ones that you'll see on the left side of the screen there. So mostly community-based services related to physical health, mental health, and behavioral health. There's the psychiatric residential treatment facility is on the list as well. And then the early intensive developmental and behavioral intervention services, the EIDBI services. It might be more important even to think about what services are out of scope, and so you'll see some examples on the right side there. That first bullet is largely saying that facility fees are out of scope, and so this is what we're paying the practitioner, not the facility. Facility fees are out of scope of this study. And then many of our cost-informed rates, rates that use cost reports, are out of the scope of this particular study as well. And then home and community-based waiver services, as you're familiar with those, are out of scope. I will mention many of the, at least the two bullets at the on the top of the right side of the screen, those have received attention from the legislature and the department over the years and have been updated more recently than some of the rates that we'll see here today.
So I'm going to jump in real quick. So we do have two members that are online, and so they're able to see you, and they may not be able to see what's on the screen. And so when you jump from slide to slide, I would just request that the presenters just say that we're moving to the next slide.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yes. Thank you. So moving to slide six with the heading entitled recommendations. This is just a high-level recommendation slide of the entire report. Again, we'll talk a little bit more detail about these as we dive into the details. But the first recommendation there is really to more fully adopt the Medicare usage of the resource-based relative value system. We'll talk about what that is in a minute, but that's the rate methodology we currently employ deploy in order to pay for physical health services in the program. Second there is to adopt some market-based rate factors and include some inflationary indexes. Again, this is related to that ability to move away from static rate methodology so we can be a little bit more nimble within the healthcare delivery system. And then third, to eliminate some rate increases and decreases that are currently in the system that are adding some complexity and inconsistencies throughout the system. So that was kind of bucket one that we talked about. So I'm moving now to slide eight, titled Rate Methodology Basics at the top. And so we're moving into sort of bucket two of the presentation, which dives – did I skip a slide? Oh, apologies. I skipped a slide. Excuse me. So slide seven, titled Resource-Based Relative Value Scale. This dives into the rate methodology that we currently use in the Medicaid fee-for-service program related to physical health services. So that raises the question, what are those services? And so you'll see listed on the slide generally six services that are included within the physician services section of our payment methodology. And so this really includes anything that we largely pay a physician to do. So think about taking a kid in for a sick visit or think of a neurosurgeon doing brain surgery. The professional side of that, all of those are paid using this particular methodology, the resource-based relative value scale. Includes all those other providers in there, things like physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech-language pathology, some behavioral health services, chiropractic care. And so in the grand scheme of the Medicaid fee-for-service program, this is probably the largest methodology we use by codes, right? Healthcare providers bill CPT and HCPCS codes usually to us, and this accounts for about 10,000 codes that we cover within the Medicaid program. Moving on to slide eight, titled Rate Methodology Basics. At a high level, what we're doing is using the resource-based relative value system, which is something that's developed and maintained annually by the Medicare program and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And the idea within this particular methodology is sort of to account for a payment that that recognizes the relative effort that goes into providing that care. And so you can imagine that a provider who maybe has a higher level decision-making ability or maybe has higher training might have more inputs into the delivery of that particular service than another provider. And I'll show some examples, some tangible examples of that to illustrate the point. One of the benefits of using a methodology like this, and you'll see that this theme throughout the presentation and the rate study, is to really look at what are the inputs in delivering the care instead of looking at what is the charges that providers submit to delivering the care, since charges might not always directly relate to how much it costs to deliver the care. And so that's one reason to use this resource-based methodology here that we do use. As I mentioned, it's used by Medicare and updated annually, and we'll talk about the details of that as well. And we here in Minnesota adopted it in statute in 2011, but we do so in a budget-neutral way. And I just want to highlight that to make sure everybody sticks that in their mind about the budget-neutral, because that largely illustrates some of the challenges we have with this methodology and is directly related to the recommendation we have that the report puts forward to try to address. And so I'll talk about that in detail as well. Moving to slide nine, titled How It Works. This is just a very high level of how the payment methodology works. I'll just caveat this is going to get into a little detail. If you're not a super detailed person like the big picture, just bear with me for a second. I'll show you the big picture in a second. I know some folks like the detail and to understand sometimes what the challenge is. Sometimes the detail is helpful. So feel free to kind of take what you like and leave what you don't here. But largely this methodology is a multiplying exercise where we take the relative value. So I mentioned that before, sort of how much input does the provider put into delivering the care and multiply that by a conversion factor. And a conversion factor is just a dollar figure. And I'll show an example of this in a second. But the conversion factor allows different payers, so Medicare, us, other payers, to choose different conversion factors that ends in a different reimbursement rate at the end. That relative value, just understand a little bit how Medicare goes about that. As I mentioned, they do update that once a year. And they attempt to look at what are the provider inputs into that, right? What is the level of education the provider might put into that? What is the level of decision-making? All the different things that the provider is using in order to deliver the care to a particular member. They look at the practice expense. So this differs in some situations, but might look at the, you know, the cost of turning the lights on, the cost of internet in order to run your clinic, depending on some specific situations there. Look at potential supplies or equipment needed in order to deliver the care, right? Do you need a heart monitor? Do you need an ECG, et cetera, that kind of stuff. And some of those things are paid separately, but it's, some of those are contemplated as well. And then also looks at the malpractice experience for providers. And so those three things together roll up into what is the relative value of delivering the particular service. So as promised, here are just two examples. I randomly picked these examples because they illustrate different relative values, but these are real examples. These are real codes that we pay for, Medicare pays for, and I'm using real data. I just picked random two particular codes to illustrate the point. And so you'll see on the left side a code that is covered for smoking cessation. You'll see on the very left blue bubble, the relative value determined by Medicare is a 0.42. And then it's multiplied by the conversion factor. This is Medicare's 2024 conversion factor, their real conversion factor of $32.74. You multiply those two together, and you see that the reimbursement rate, the base reimbursement rate, is $13.75. The other example on the right side, again, just to illustrate the point of how these relative values work, is a code for first hour critical care. You'll see there that it's got a relative value of 7.9 multiplied by the exact same conversion factor. That's how Medicare does it. Again, 32.74. And you get a payment rate of $258.65. And so you see the only difference here is the relative value that's used. And if you think about it, you could kind of intuitively see that maybe a critical care situation is going to require higher level decision making. It's this one on the right is an hour code. The one on the left is a 10-minute code. And so if you did the math, you can obviously get a little closer. And so those are the types of things that go into sort of the development of the rate. And this is sort of the base equation. There are some other factors that we'll illustrate in the future here, too. So that was kind of down in the weeds. So bringing it up a little bit more to look at the aggregate impact across the program, and this is where I had mentioned to keep in mind that budget neutral aspect. And so what this chart is showing is the payment in the Medicaid program, the fee-for-service Medicaid program, relative to what Medicare pays. And so you're seeing on the left side of the screen for 2013, the Medicaid program here in Minnesota paid approximately 80% of what the Medicare program would have paid for the same services in the aggregate. So this is in the aggregate of those 10,000 codes that we had mentioned. Over time, because of the way that we do it here in Minnesota, because of that budget neutrality, every year our team takes the rates paid from the previous year, takes the updated relative values that we talked about, and then looks at utilization and attempts to forecast how much it'll cost the next year, and then tweak the conversion factor in order to make it budget neutral. So if you didn't catch all that, essentially we have to tweak our conversion factor in order to spend about the same that we did the year before. So if we spent $100 million the year before, we're attempting to spend $100 million the second year. And so over time, over the 10 years that's illustrated in this graph, you'll see that that exercise has resulted in us now in 2023 covering around 74% of what Medicare would have paid. So again, that's what we in the fee-for-service Medicaid program pay relative to Medicare, so a reduction of around 6%. I just want to illustrate this is not a dollar value, right? It's this isn't saying that we pay 6% less. We're paying 6% less than what Medicare would have paid, and that number fluctuates as well. So it's a little, I just want to illustrate that's a little more complicated. And moving to slide 13, and I apologize, forgot to announce the slide switches, a couple of apologies about that. Moving to slide 13, titled Impact of Medicare Payment Methodologies. This is showing a similar concept that was just illustrated on the previous slide, but showing it at a code-by-code level. And so what we have on this chart are the 10 highest billed codes within the RBRVS methodology here in Minnesota's Medicaid program. This tells you on the right side, what it's showing you is that same concept of what we're paying in the Medicaid program relative to Medicare, but for these specific codes. And the reason I wanted to illustrate this is that in the previous slide, we saw on average, we pay about 74% of Medicare, but code by code, that differs. And so just to illustrate that point, you'll see about in the middle of the screen, that psychotherapy for 45 minutes. You'll see that in that situation, we are paying about 92% of what the Medicare program pays. But conversely, the last code on the slide there, that therapeutic exercise, therapeutic activity code there, you'll see we pay about 71% of the Medicare rate. And so distributed across those 10,000 codes that we mentioned, our costs, our relativeness to Medicare varies because of all those multiplying factors that we talked about earlier. Moving next to slide 14, titled Additional Methodology Components, I showed you the first two portions, the relative value and the conversion factor of the methodology, and that is the crux of it, but there are some additional components. And I'm showing these to illustrate some of the technical nuances and the complexity related to the rate methodology we talked about, trying to address complexity. And so this is part of that. And so right in the middle of the screen there, you'll see that there's an additional factor that takes into consideration that's considered in the methodology called the Geographic Practice Cost Index. This is something that Medicare uses as well and establishes one per state. And all this is attempting to do is to recognize that some states are more expensive than others, right? It's more expensive to run a healthcare clinic in New York City than it is in Minneapolis, most likely, right? And so this is what this is attempting to do. And so we multiply our RBRVS rates by that Geographic Practice Cost Index. And then we here in Minnesota, in statute, have several rate increases and decreases that apply to different rates within the system. And so multiplying all these together is how you get the reimbursement rate. And on the next slide here, slide 15, titled Transparency, you'll see some examples of those rate increases and decreases. This is a small sample of the ones that exist in statute today. But this is partly what causes some confusion and lack of transparency about what we pay. And so these rate increases and decreases, even though they apply to the RBRVS system, they don't necessarily apply to all providers, and they don't necessarily apply to all providers the same. And so some, like the 3% might apply to a physical therapist, but the 5% might not apply to a physical therapist. And so when we have a particular code, it can be challenging for us to communicate in a consistent and clear way to providers that if you bill us this code, this is what we pay. And you can see here that there are also some reductions that apply depending on the provider that's delivering the care. And there's sometimes some rate increases or decreases depending on like severity of the patient and the delivery of that particular care as well. So all those things, especially when you add numerous ones of them, again, this is a small sample, so there are tons of them in statute, it increases the complexity and lack of transparency within the system. Moving to the next slide, which is not numbered, so it must be slide 16, titled Recommendations. So this is the recommendation specifically related to the physical health services that I just talked about. And so the recommendation that's articulated in the rate study in partnership with our consultant and in partnership with providers is to adopt the Medicare RBRVS system the way they do it. And so essentially that functionally means to remove that budget neutral aspect that we are currently using. Following on to that would be to follow the annual updates that they do. We do use their annual updates to the relative values, but then we have to sort of water that down or kind of pull some of that back by making it budget neutral. And so we lose some of that annual recognition of changes within the healthcare marketplace and trying to stay a little bit more current about what the providers are incurring in order to deliver the care. And then lastly is to eliminate the increases and decreases that exist in statute related to this. We certainly understand these were all well-intentioned by all of us to ensure that providers were able to deliver care and whatnot, but it's caused a lot of complexity. And so if we move to the Medicare rate, we think it makes sense simultaneously to eliminate some of those rate increases and decreases to make the system a lot more transparent and kind of make the system a little easier for everybody to understand. With that concludes the first two buckets, so that portion on the physical services, and I'll turn it over to my colleague, Ms. Grom.
So I'll just take a quick pause here to see if any members have any questions before we dive into any more of the information. Go ahead.
I'm not on the committee. Do I still get to ask questions?
You sure do.
Awesome. Thank you. This is super complicated, and I have I want to go back to slide 13. And my question is, I guess my overall, when you surveyed providers, I'm sure across the board you heard that rates are abysmally low. And I'm wondering, did the survey include looking at those rates? And my question is, who determines, you know, are we paying 85% of Medicare? Are we paying 71% of the Medicare rate? Who decides that, number one? And was there any correlation in looking at the percentages of the rates and the actual outcomes in the services provided those individuals? Was there any kind of evaluation that said, okay, if we increase rates, we're going to have better outcomes? Or was that not part of this particular study? Thank you.
Mr. Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So I'll start by saying that this particular section of the report, the physical health services side, had was a little bit more clear-cut in trying to get to a recommendation. Ms. Grom will talk about some other ones that had a lot more provider engagement, but largely speaking, providers are generally supportive of moving to pay closer to the Medicare rate. And the short answer is we didn't necessarily correlate our recommendations in this study with outcomes per se. I think we're recognizing that because of the budget neutral implications that we currently use in the RBRVS rate, we're just paying considerably below market and trying to address that kind of base problem. To the first question that you answered about how do we get to these numbers, this is an exercise that my team goes through every year. So every year in around December, CMS releases their updates. We review those updates, and then we bucket them into three major buckets. One of them is evaluation and management and OB services, mental health, and then all other codes. And we essentially tweak the conversion factor, that dollar number that you saw in the equation, in order to get the bottom number to total. Now, we're definitely trying to do that in a way that hits many of the policy priorities we often talk about here at the legislature and at the department about ensuring access to care and all that kind of stuff. But as I mentioned, there are 10,000 codes. And so it's I would say, probably impossible to do a conversion factor by code or everything like that, right? And so we try to hit as many policy objectives that we have, like focusing on mental health, focusing on OB services. But these kind of play out. And the one thing that I didn't necessarily mention is when we do that exercise, we're also multiplying by utilization. And so some codes like these ones that you mentioned here, these top 10, have an outsized impact than the codes that are billed 50 times a year, for example, right? And so trying to reconcile all those moving pieces can be a considerable challenge. We attempt to do that as best we can, but that the exercise is done by team members at the department.
Okay. Next up, we'll go to Representative Elkins and then Representative Baker, who's online. Representative Elkins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got two questions. First one is, if the recommendation is that we move from the current compensation to 100% of Medicare, and we're currently on average at about 74% of Medicare, have you estimated what the fiscal impact of that would be?
Mr. Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Representative, yes, that is the recommendation. We haven't completed a fiscal note to determine exactly the cost of that, but it's something we'll work on.
Okay. And then the second question is that a general criticism of RVS methodology is that while it may have been an improvement on the preceding methodology, it probably still overcompensates specialists and undercompensates general practitioners and probably mental health providers as well. So if we go back to just straight units, these units without any other adjustments and we'd be giving up perhaps leverage to raise the rates for mental health and mental and behavioral health procedures in particular as an incentive to encourage more people to join those professions. Is that something you're thinking about as well?
Mr. Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Kind of at a very preliminary analysis, it suggests that going to 100% of the Medicare rate is beneficial to everybody as an initial step. But your point is well taken that the RVU system does recognize some of those things. There are ways that we, the state, could look at accounting for that. I think we would recommend some strategies to do that in a way that still accomplishes some of the other goals of the study, which is some increased transparency and more consistency. But there are ways to do what you're recommending if we as a state decide we want to make sure that these folks are compensated a little higher relative to these folks.
Thank you.
All right, next up, Representative Baker, who's joining us online.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the opportunity to kind of zoom in on this important discussion. As we kind of, I know this is just a informational hearing, no decisions get made today, but from the leadership standpoint, there's a lot of the rates here that kind of slide over to both committees that we work with here, both human side and health side. When I say that, it's Chair Knorr or Chair Liebling. Do you know which will this land in when it comes to maybe some budgeting or some planning on this adjustment here? Has that been clearly been defined at this point? Because I'm as I sit on human, I want to know where to point the efforts and or if it's on health. Has that been determined yet? And I don't know if you know that, Mr. Chair, or it's more of an internal baseball. But I want to know where do I focus on which committee is going to kind of be handling this financial issue?
Thank you, Representative Baker. I think one of the things that all the committees, whether we're talking about Human Services Policy, Finance, or the Health Committee, is that we're looking at a session that's going to be a limited number of meetings that we're able to hold. And so I think trying to take a team approach to some of this, but if Chair Knorr wants to weigh in here, I think it would be a good opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. That's a good question. So we will be evaluating the process as we move forward. As you're aware of, the budget year was last year, so we're looking into ways to make sure that we are able to address this issue. So we'll come up with a plan at the beginning of session. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, again, if I just could follow up with that, I think I understand that, and we are running out of time with our time allowed in this legislative session. So every hour we spend talking about this is important, but I want to make sure that we get that clearly identified with all committee members on both committees so that we kind of know where that focus is. So I just want to make sure that it's brought out so we get that clarity here as soon as possible, because this is going to be a very, very short session with time running out because we used so much of it last year. So thank you for your time, and I appreciate this. Thank you.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question on slide 16 where you have the number 2, follow annual updates. Could you comment a little bit more on what the barriers to the following those annual updates are? Do they end up being strictly legislative approval for cost, or could you go into that a little bit more?
Mr. Hayes, I am going to ask you to be brief in the answer, too, because I want to make sure we get to all of our testifiers as well.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The annual updates are done by Medicare where they update the relative value. So kind of getting back to the question over here, they recently actually updated the relative values to get mental health some additional resources that happened for the 24 session. And so we take those relative values, but then we have to water them down because we have to budget neutral. So if we get rid of the budget neutral part, we can take those relative value updates every year and filter them through the process over term. And then hopefully you don't see that number going down in that line graph, but hopefully staying equal relative to Medicare.
All right, next up is Ms. Graham, Legislative Director for Behavioral Health, Housing, Deaf, Hard of Hearing, Disabilities Service, Minnesota Department of Human Services. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Christy Graham with the Department of Human Services. So I'm going to transition us to talking more about mental health, SUD, Substance Use Disorder Services, and EIDBI. So Mr. Hayes mentioned that there are some mental health services that are covered or part of the RBRVS system. But many of our mental health rates are not included in the RBRVS methodology. We also have our SUD rates and all of our EIDBI rates that aren't part of that RBRVS methodology. So these services are coded differently. In some cases, the characteristics of how they're delivered might be a little bit different. And they have what we sometimes call flat rates or historic rates. So these are rates that were set by the legislature many, many years ago, probably before some of us were even here. Oftentimes they haven't been looked at or adjusted for many years, and they don't keep pace with inflation automatically. So until last session, when the legislature was gracious enough to fund ongoing inflationary updates for mental health services and a small 3% increase, these rates have been largely untouched. So we've got reports that really date back to, this is our most recent report, but we've been looking at our mental health rates and our SUD rates for a long time now. So we've had other studies dating back to at least 2018 And all of these studies are really saying the same thing that this report does, is that our rates, our mental health rates, our behavioral health rates really aren't based on anything. There's no justifiable provider cost or data that these rates are based on. They're just sort of set arbitrarily. Oftentimes, when the legislature is facing, you know, particular economic forecasts and making our best guess at what those rates should be. What these reports have also said is that these rates aren't keeping pace with the cost. So our Medicaid fee-for-service rates don't actually cover the cost to provide the rates. So provider costs are exceeding those. That's obviously a big problem for the financial sustainability of our behavioral health system. It's a big concern for DHS. So we know that there's escalating behavioral health needs in the community. We see escalating SUD issues, escalating mental health issues across populations. So it's not just kids or adults. We're even seeing older adults who are having different types of escalating complex kind of comorbid conditions. And so rates are a really big part of how we can address and serve these individuals and these families as a part of our system. Many of you have probably heard about individuals being stuck in hospitals who are having maybe psychiatric crises and maybe co-occurring developmental disabilities or autism or related disorders. Addressing behavioral health rates in the way that we're recommending in this report is a way for us to get upstream and to prevent some of those people from ending up in the hospital or those acute care settings in the first place. It's not the only way that we can address that issue, but it's a big part of what the potential is for these recommendations. And then lastly on this slide, and I should have announced, Mr. Chair, apologies, I'm on slide 17. Some of our mental health services are covered by the medical assistance program, but they're not covered by commercial insurers, or at least they're not uniformly covered by commercial insurers. So you might have heard about this a little bit last session in discussions around psychiatric residential treatment facilities, for example. I believe the Commerce Committee worked on that primarily, as well as Chair Liebling's committee, to make sure that commercial insurers did have to pay for PRTF. But we have other rates like adult rehabilitative mental health services, sometimes called ARMS, or children's therapeutic services and support, CTSS, that are not uniformly covered by commercial insurers. So the impact we're making here in creating these market-based rates really crosses populations and has a huge impact on many communities across the state. And then moving to slide 18. So what do we do about getting these rates to where they should be, where we can make sure that we're reimbursing providers reasonably for the cost that they incur to provide the service, and so that people can access these high-quality services? So what we've recommended in this report and in the rate models you'll see towards the end of the report is establishing market-based rates. So we used an independent rate-setting process, with the foundation really being data sources that we know about, so the Bureau of Labor Statistics, what other states might be doing, any data sets that the vendors that we worked with could get their hands on and really start to understand what are some of the cost inputs for these rates, where do we need to start. And then following that, we worked with the provider community. We did a lot of surveys, extensive community engagement to say, let us know what your costs are, provide some justification to us of what those costs are. And that was sort of an iterative process. So it wasn't just we surveyed and we got results. It was we surveyed and maybe we didn't get all the results we wanted, so we reached out again and said, we need more information here. Or, we don't really agree with that, with your assumption, provider, but can you give us more information to back that up? So that was an iterative process that sort of layers on top of and helped inform the data that we used to compute these rates. Another factor I just wanted to mention in this is where kind of medical or physical health procedures are often pretty uniform, pretty consistent across states. Community-based services look a lot different. So states bundle services in different ways. States might be providing the same exact service but use a different federal authority. So, for example, you might be providing an HCBS service using an 1115 demonstration waiver or 1915C waiver, and the provider expectations could differ based on those federal authorities. States have different staffing ratios. There are different clinical standards across states. So in light of that, when we were looking at setting rates for our behavioral health services and for EIDBI, we really needed to consider that state-specific input to make sure we were getting them right. So in some ways, it's a little bit more complex than RBRVS, but I think that RBRVS is more complex than this work. So moving to the next slide. Slide 19. So talking a little bit about how we came up with the cost inputs for our behavioral health rate recommendations and EIDBI rates in this report. So really looked at four main factors with the premise that we wanted to build something that was easy to understand, that was transparent, that was much more simplistic than the system that we have right now. And we wanted to focus on building it from the ground up, kind of that process that I just described where we look at data and then we layer on top and inform that data with what the provider community is experiencing and what people are experiencing essentially. So there's kind of, it all boils down to four main factors that we can look at when we build these, rate models that are in the report. The first being direct staff worker wages and benefits. So this is pretty straightforward, salaries, fringe benefits, all of that, that you need to understand, not just what they are today, but what they need to be in order to attract and retain the right professionals to deliver high quality services. The second factor that we looked at and that we kind of put into the rate models is direct staff time. So what's billable and what's not? So how many hours is a mental health professional, for example, working directly with a participant or a client? Those are billable hours. And then how many hours are they in staff meetings? Are they doing clinical consultation with their supervisor? Maybe they're at an important training. Those are critical to activities that are critical to their job too, but they're not necessarily billable under Medicaid. So we needed to make sure that that we really included those costs and considered that as a part of this methodology. Program-related expenses. So these are expenses that are really specific to the type of service that's being delivered. So for mental health or behavioral health services, you're going to have different kinds of program expenses in a residential program versus an outpatient program. You might have client activities that you do in an inpatient SUD program where you bring people to the community that are really important for their social well-being and connectedness, but not necessarily something that we capture under our billable expenses. And then lastly, administrative costs. So these are the costs that any business would have when they're doing business. And so things like human resources, payroll expenses, hiring an executive director, maybe building expenses, malpractice insurance, things like that. So those are the four main buckets that very simply put equate to a payment rate. I do want to mention as a part of this slide, we talked a lot of our conversations, we did talk about rate adjusters. Sometimes you hear about these being referred to as rate add-ons or enhanced rates, or sometimes rate cutbacks. And so that's not pictured on this slide here, but those were certainly a part of our conversation. So these could be rate enhancements or add-ons that address a particular level of client acuity. They could be in place because they require a certain level of professional. This is the case for EIDBI in many ways when you look at how their rates are structured and the professionals that can deliver those services at particular rates. They could be based on staffing ratio requirements and also culturally specific or culturally responsive services. We have extreme disparities in our Medicaid system. Behavioral health is no exception, and so we really need to be looking at are there some providers that need to get additional funding to be able to do those critical services for the communities that they're expert in. Then moving to slide 20. So the scope, just kind of on this slide, this just talks a little bit about the scope of what we're doing in terms of the market-based or the behavioral health and EIDBI rates. And we'll touch on each of these big buckets kind of in the next few slides briefly. But the general kind of big picture scope of this is we're looking at one-to-one group mental health and SUD services that aren't covered by RBRVS, adult and children's mental health day treatment, outpatient and residential substance use disorder services, mental health provider travel time. This is sort of a unique aspect of our system that we've maintained as a part of these recommendations. Mobile crisis services, behavioral health home services, and then EIDBI, as we've mentioned. Moving to slide 21. So this is the slide where we start to get into a little bit more detail about what some of the recommendations are in the report. I mentioned earlier that those are detailed at the end of the report in the appendices. So for mental health recommended rates, this slide, this is just a snapshot. There are too many slides to list and to go through as a part of this presentation. But you can see sort of a handful of services that we've listed and sort of the variation in how much those, what percentage of an increase or in some cases decrease those particular service lines got in terms of recommendations. So we really got into the weeds, figured out what should these rates be, and that's why you see that variation, given that they were, many of them were just based, you know, not really on anything at all. So for ARMS community intervention, for example, you see the unit of service per session, the current rate of about $51 per session, and then a recommendation that that bumps up to about $91 per session. It's about an 80% increase. So you can look through that slide and get a sense of where we're going with some of those mental health increases. One thing I want to just mention before moving to the next slide, mental health, I mentioned this earlier in the presentation, but the needs in the community have really escalated in terms of prevalence, in terms of acuity for mental health. And so it's extremely important that we take a look at these rates so we can make sure people have access to the services they need. We've worked very closely with individual providers, with provider associations. Some of them are going to be testifying today with our hospital systems. And some of the data that we're getting from some of their survey results is truly alarming, where we're seeing people on waiting lists for 14 weeks to get outpatient services. We've got almost double amount of children ending up in the ERs from, I think, between 2018 and 2023, almost double children in ERs because of mental health issues. So I just want to say as a part of this slide, just to kind of bring it back to people, we're talking a lot about technical rate jargon here, but this is all really about making sure that people have access to these services. And then moving to slide 22, I did want to take some time and talk a little bit about behavioral health home. So this is behavioral health home recommended rates. So this slide shows the totality of the recommendations for behavioral health home. There's just the two kind of service lines right now. But behavioral health home, for those that don't know, is a fully integrated model for individuals, both adults and children who have mental illness or emotional disturbance and are oftentimes experiencing a lot of kind of other issues in their lives where they need some support and they need sort of an integrated team approach to help them stay well. So this is a really important model. Right now we have kind of two service lines. There's the rates right now are funded for an initial 6 months at $350 per month. It's a monthly per diem that providers get reimbursed. And the thought initially was that this is a limited set of initial payments at that level because there's more of a need in terms of meeting people where they're at, kind of getting them connected to services, just some of those kind of startup costs when you're initially engaging with an individual who's experiencing, you know, crisis in many cases. But the recommendations of this report are really took a look at kind of what the costs are, what the services are that are provided across not just the first 6 months, but all of the time span of when an individual is getting these services. And we came up with a recommendation of one statewide rate that would be a monthly per diem of about $409 a month. And this is something I do want to note that the provider community has brought forward for the past couple of sessions to create that uniform statewide rate. And so we're really excited that we got to a place where we know what that rate should be and that hopefully we can simplify that methodology in the future. Moving on to slide 23, substance use disorder recommended rates. So this slide also shows kind of the full gamut of SUD services ranging from comprehensive assessments to peer services to both residential and outpatient services. So we're able to get all of them on one slide here, and you can see that there's some pretty significant increases for the most part in all of these SUD services. And then moving to the next slide, kind of want to illustrate one in particular. So residential SUD services, this is slide 24. What we found in our work with our vendor and with our provider community was that all SUD services are really needing to get increased, but residential services in particular are really low. And so you can see on this graphic the low-intensity residential, I think, is about 171% below where it should be. And we've got about a 60% gap or so on the high intensity residential treatment. So, as the legislature is thinking about, what the economic forecast looks like, where priorities might lie. I think one of our recommendations that's not explicitly stated in this report would be to maybe start with residential SUD services, if we're needing to make some of those scaling decisions. So next, really quickly, I'll try to manage time here. Mr. Chair, wanted to talk just a little bit about the impact of ASAM, or American Society of Addiction Medicine, reforms. So ASAM is kind of evidence-based criteria that really helps move programs away from sort of volume-driven models of care to being more person-centered, being more culturally specific, more clinical and outcomes-driven in nature. So the beginning of implementing ASAM in Minnesota started, I think, back in, 2011 with our SUD demonstration that we've been, that we've implemented for a while now. And then the legislature in recent years has codified the ASAM requirements for SUD providers, which is really exciting. So as of January 1 of this year, 2024, all of our residential providers are now compliant with ASAM and working towards those standards and delivering a higher quality of care. And as of January 1st of next year, 2025, our outpatient providers will be doing the same. So right now, the way that providers are recognized for providing this higher level of care is through what I mentioned earlier, enhanced rates. So for outpatient providers, they receive a 20% enhancement on their current base rate. And then for residential providers, they get a 25% enhancement on their current base rate. So what we did as a part of this rate study is really trying to simplify, looked at the base rate, looked at what it requires to deliver those higher quality of services under ASAM, and figured out what is an appropriate base rate for everyone. Everyone's going to be moving to ASAM anyways, and so we don't need those two rates anymore. So that's part of our recommendations, is really to consolidate into one rate for all providers, taking into account those requirements under ASAM. Another sort of change that we made in this aspect is related to SUD rate add-ons. So right now we have, I think, about 5 rate add-ons. We've got a rate add-on for co-occurring disorders, medically complex, disability-specific, culturally responsive, and families and children. And so those are rates that get layered again on top of a base rate when a program is serving a particular population at a higher level. And so as a part of this study and these recommendations and the larger ASAM reforms, we've eliminated a couple of those add-ons to make things simpler and integrated those costs of what it would take into the base rate. So we've eliminated, I think, medically complex and disability specific. And so those are all a part of the base rate, and we've maintained the family families program, so people who are attending treatment with children, co-occurring disorders, and culturally responsive, feeling that those were really rate add-ons that we need to maintain in our system. Just a quick note on this, the ASAM has been updated just this past October, so there's a 4th edition of ASAM now. I think that's the first update in about 10 years or so. So hopefully we won't have another one soon, but we're going to continue to work with our vendor to look at what the 4th edition means for providers and if we need to make some further tweaks to SUD rates as a part of these recommendations. And lastly, moving to early intensive developmental behavioral interventions on slide 26, our recommended rates. So EIDBI, for those that don't know or might need a refresher, is our autism, our Medicaid autism service for people who are under 21 and have autism or related disorders or conditions. And so this is a benefit that's really educating, training, supporting families, working on promoting independence and self-autonomy, making sure people have access to services in the community and having a life and in the community, going to school. Things like that, and improving really long-term outcomes. EIDBI, being that it's for a younger population, is really important because we need to make sure we hit specific developmental windows with certain interventions to have the best outcomes. And so you'll see here a snapshot again. I couldn't fit all of the services on this slide, but wanted to give you a sense of where we're going. So these services are also, by and large, getting some pretty significant increases. And you can look at the specifics of those in the rate model section of the report, but wanted to give you a sense of what those are. I will say shout out to the EADBI provider community. It's always challenging getting information when we do surveys from providers. It's always an issue. But I think the EADBI provider community had like 80% plus response rate. So we got some really good cost information from them and had some really good conversations. So we're proud of those recommendations as well. And I think that wraps it up for the part of my presentation. We're happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Graham. I'll just start with the first question. Some of the recommendations for the rate changes, what would that do to federal matching dollars? Could we anticipate that if we raised, as a state legislature, some of the rates, that that would also increase some federal funds coming into Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. So these are all services that are approved in our state plan agreement with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. They all get a matching rate, and so they would all be federally matchable. So this would be leveraging those federal dollars as well.
All right, with that, I will turn it over to the questions. First up, we have Representative Hicks, who's online.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Ms. Grom, for being here. A couple of quick questions. The first question is related specifically to CTSS and skills. So I didn't see it on the slide, but I know it's in the rate study. And when we talk about CTSS, specifically when we talk about skills, can you share with us the last time skills had a rate increase? Do you happen to have that information? I feel like it was like 2007 or 2008, but I don't want to say that if I'm wrong.
Ms. Graham.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hicks, thank you for the question. I would have to get back to you with the specifics, but it's not been any time recently. So that could be correct.
Thank you. And the reason that I bring that up is I'm not sure how many folks on the committee have any experience with CTSS skills, but CTSS skills is, in my opinion as a parent, one of the most valuable services a child with significant emotional needs can access on Minnesota Medicaid. So what skills does, and I know we have testifiers who can maybe talk about this a little bit later too, is it takes the skills that young adults and children are working on in therapy, and it helps them apply those skills in community. So they come into the home, they support in other community environments like Target or Walmart or the park or social events or things like that, and help take the skills that they've learned in therapy in those one-to-one settings and apply them in community. And skills specifically hasn't really been a focus. And so in our community, in my community, there are wait lists for the wait list, and many of the wait lists for skills are closed. And so children who are in therapy, who the therapist says are making great progress, but need to be able to apply those skills, have no one to help them learn to apply. Because we have wait lists for the wait list. Again, you're on the list to get on the wait list at this point in my community. And so that is incredibly frustrating as a parent. But it's also really bad for the system. Because if we don't have kids getting skills to apply what they're learning in the community, then we see them struggle with needing more intensive services. It also impacts workforce. And so Ms. Grom, please correct me if I'm wrong, but skills workers are usually folks that are currently in school to be mental health professionals. They're practitioners?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, I believe that's correct.
Representative Hicks.
When I was in school and coming up in the field, a lot of folks were skills workers while they were coming in to becoming mental health professionals. And so if the rate doesn't pay enough to hire them and to support the service, then we don't have people coming into the field either. And we just sort of are on this hamster wheel we can't seem to get ourselves out of. And so skills is an area that I'm really passionate about. I didn't see it on the slide. And so I just sort of wanted to call that out and ask Ms. Grom if she wouldn't mind, kind of highlighting what percentage increase, if any, was recommended for skills.
Ms. Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, I am just pulling up the appendix. There's about 130 different rates here, so it might take me a minute to scroll through and find that.
I'll ask my second question if that's okay, Chair.
I just found it, actually, I believe. So there's several different rates. that can be used to bill, Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks' skills. And so it sort of ranges in terms of the increases, but we're looking at between a 112% increase to a 26% increase. For example, 112% increase for individual skills training under CTSS and about 26.3% for group, 63% for family skills training.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you, Ms. Grom. And then my other question is, how does this rate study impact the rates that the MCOs pay or don't pay? Do they pay the same? Like, if we increase the rates on the fee-for-service side, do the MCOs respond accordingly? Is that based on contract? Is that based on their preference? Like, how does this impact the MCOs, since we know so many of our children specifically who are struggling with mental health are currently being served through an MCO?
So I'm going to jump in real quick and say that we do have four more members with questions and seven more people that are lined up to testify. So I want to make sure that we have time for everybody. So Ms. Grom, if you could make that brief, and then we'll move on to the next member.
Mr. Chair, I'm actually going to have Mr. Hayes respond to that MCO question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks. So real briefly, just to say, it kind of depends on what the rate is. There are certainly some directed payments that you know of in managed care, and so in some situations it might be the same. But generally speaking, managed care organizations do have some flexibility in paying their own rates determined by their organizations as well. So this rate study, hypothetically speaking, if the legislature were to adopt it, would have some impacts to managed care. It would be a little bit different depending on the rates and the statutory construct around some of those.
Thank you, Mr. Hayes.
Mr. Hayes. Next up, we have
Edelson and then Representative Bonner. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank you guys for this rate study. I think it's very helpful. A few things, as I think you already know, our supplemental budget is probably not going to cover the cost on all of this. And so while I would love to see all of this, I think it's going to be really important when session starts to get approximations on how raising rates for each one of these would cost so that we can start to make some tough decisions, because unfortunately that's what we do here, right? So I just want to thank you, though. It's great.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, and I think I will tie a little bit into some of what's already been said, but I think there's a widespread agreement around this table that there is a need for some rate adjustments, and I don't think that's really a debate. I think we realize that. Granted, to Representative Edelson's point, and Representative Elkins, we obviously do have to make tough decisions, and we will have to wait for the fiscal notes to determine what is feasible, within our budget. But that said, and I understand the importance of raising rates for viability of these programs, increasing access to services, meeting people where they are, all of those things. But I also want to kind of pan out just a little bit into the big picture, right? So we know that raising rates is not a panacea, right, to get folks more care. We're facing incredible worker shortages. And even if we increase rates to encourage individuals to come into the marketplace, realistically, those providers are not going to be online in the near future. It's going to take multiple years to get those folks trained, to get them into the profession, all of those things. And I think one of the strategies that we may have to discuss in that larger landscape is a lot about prevention. This is a really large and complex issue with and I think it's going to take a multifaceted approach. So my question to you, Ms. Grom, is could you speak a little bit about how the rates fit into the larger strategy and talk maybe a little bit about what other things that are being proposed that might have more impact on the preventative side to kind of ease that interim? Because obviously these things, even if we do them, they're not going to solve the whole problem. They're just a small part of the solution. Could you maybe just briefly kind of talk to the larger strategy and how these fit into that?
Ms. Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonner, thank you for the question. So I think that's a really good point. Rates are one lever that we have. We don't have many levers, and so rates is an important one, but there are certainly other interventions, other public policy interventions that we need to consider. And the legislature has. Last session, we did a lot of work in this space as well. I would say a few things to your point around workforce. We have all kinds of groups meeting right now. Our community is meeting, putting forward recommendations on what we can do to better address, to make things easier for people to become a mental health professional, to make things easier for Black, Indigenous, people of color to be able to get into the field as well. So those are important things that we need to be working on, and we should, I believe the state should consider investing in or making policy changes around. On the prevention side, I think school-linked services, early childhood services are really important. So we had a significant investment in school-linked services last session. There is a bit of a funding cliff in the future on that, and those are really critical services. I think I just saw a study from, I want to say the University of Minnesota, but I might have got it wrong, about some of the evidence-based outcomes when we've got mental health services, providers co-located in the school setting and providing those services early on. There are some really, really good outcomes for that work. Those services are catching kids that our system might not catch until years down the road, when they might be at a place where they would be considering outpatient psychotherapy, for example. So early childhood as well. So we've got some consultation services. We need to be probably looking at more early childhood grants to support earlier interventions. And aside from that, I think there's all kinds of ideas that the mental health community is working on. We could probably spend hours talking about some of the ideas that we have, but those are some of the top things that sort of came to my mind in light of your question. Happy to talk with you more offline about other ideas. Maybe one that I didn't mention that I probably should, I guess, now that I'm thinking about this, is complex care. Transition. So we have a lot of ideas around how to better support individuals who are getting stuck in hospitals that don't necessarily mean a rate increase. It might mean creating some flexibilities for MIN choices assessments. It might mean changing some of the rules and taking some of the federal authorities or enacting some of those in state law so that certain workers can provide services in hospitals and help transition those individuals back to the community or to an appropriate setting. So lots of ideas that we'd love to bring to you. And I will say, though, that rates is really, it's clearly been noted as a priority from the community, and so it's a priority for DHS as well.
Thank you. Quick follow-up.
Thank you, Ms. Graham, for that. And I think there's probably no secret in this room that I am a big fan of early childhood grants, as well as preventative services, including school-based services, to catch some of these challenges early. And so I appreciate that you brought those forward in your commentary. And I really do appreciate that you had a good answer with a thoughtful approach on how we look at the overall strategy. And I think that gives a lot of context for what we're discussing here today with regard to rates. Thank you.
All right. Representative Votney, and then it'll be Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Edelson kind of spoke to many of the concerns that I had. Surprised that we can have all this study, make a recommendation, and we go from 74 to 100% and not be able to have what that number is. And I did barely make it through junior high math, but if you could just tell me what we're paying right now at 74%, and then I can do the math myself, what would that cost?
Mr. Chair, members, I have that on my computer, and I can pull it up for you in a matter of a few minutes here if you'd like, but I don't have it off the top of my head.
Representative Votney.
I can wait.
Okay. Maybe follow up after the committee hearing?
I'd like to get it on tape at some point here, so if there's we can circle back to it after the other questions.
Perfect.
Mr. Chair, we're happy to provide as we continue to work through this. This is a huge endeavor, and it's taken a lot of staff time across the department. People have worked really hard on this, and the fiscal aspect is important to us, and we can certainly follow up with that information in totality, not just the 74% of the RVRVS that you referenced.
Thoughts?
Surprise. Thank you, Chair. Go ahead.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. I'll try and keep this really quick. Just one question. I'm looking at slide 19, which has the market-based rate-setting components for some of these mental health care procedures that there aren't currently federal rates for. And I think, based on what I'm hearing, that that certainly moving in the short term from where we are right now to rates based on observed costs is probably an incremental step in the right direction. But to some of Representative Hicks's comments, we really, I think, want to end up basing the rates more on value than observed costs. And my observation has been that provider organizations in general aren't very good at managerial accounting. So if I look at the work that went into calculating the proposed rates on slide 19, that's not something that the typical provider organization would be able to do easily. I'm guessing that the consultant was heavily involved in helping assemble this data and creating this model. That's kind of a question.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a really great question, actually. Yes, the vendor was involved, sort of the frontline person. That's what the legislature gave us funding to do. That was huge help, so thank you. And so they did work, and they've worked with, as Mr. Hayes mentioned, many states on this. So they did work directly with the provider community, and it was a challenge in some cases to get that information. I think, you know, to your point on value-based rates and thinking about that, that's certainly a future prospect that I think we do some of that right now in our rate methodologies in our Medicaid system, but we'd love to do more of that. I mean, the situation right now is we've got to stop the bleed, and so that's where we're at. But the other thing I will say on that is that I think that, you know, looking at provider costs at one point in time and having an inflationary update attached to make sure that there's ongoing indexing happening is great. But it might also be good to have ongoing cost reporting at some point. I don't think the provider community is quite ready to get there, given the crisis that we're in with where our rates are. They're just so low that, you know, some of our models are just almost wholly unsustainable. But that is something that we would be open to having conversations on with you and other community members.
Thank you.
Representative Kern.
Thank you, Chair. And just to address Representative Bonner's question, thank you for that earlier, too, thankfully we're doing some work on the human services policy side, and this upcoming session won't require funds for that. So we are addressing workforce shortages. One of the bills in particular that I'm working on will look at what we have as mandatory requirements in statute that might be limiting applicant pools for providers. And that's coming from direct experiences from providers working on how we might be able to amend some of that language to increase that applicant pool.
Perfect. All right. So we're going to kick it over to the other people that have showed up to testify today. I'm just going to call out the first three if the first two wants to come up, and then we can just keep moving as quick as we can. I think in order to fit everybody, if everyone wants to limit their testimony to about 2 minutes or less, that would be perfect. First up will be Kristen Anderson, and then next will be Ashley Kimmel, and then Jessica Brisbois will be up next. First up, Kristen Anderson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kirsten Anderson. I'm the executive director of Aspire Minnesota, a statewide association of child and family serving provider organizations. Today, we're here to share our gratitude and depth of hope for the future in response to the presentation of today's Medicaid outpatient rate study. Children's mental health providers have been waiting on the arrival of this rate study since a past study was first authorized by the legislature in response to the clarity now almost a decade ago that Medicaid reimbursement rates were contributing to a crisis in access to care. At that time, the legislature saw the precursor conditions to a full crisis that we're currently experiencing today, including reimbursement rates that do not meet the cost of care. Our recent survey data shows an over 40% gap for most services between the cost of delivering mental health care and our Medicaid reimbursement rates. Increasing need, more children are presenting with mental health conditions and experiencing higher acuity. Decreasing capacity. In a statewide survey of mental health providers this month, 66% reported shrinking current services, 38% reported closing services, and an additional 22% anticipate closing services in 2024, all due to inadequate rate reimbursements. All within an evolving system of care, with a loss of almost 900 beds in children's residential care since 2003, the focus is increasingly on intensive community-based models to meet child and family need. The challenge exacerbating these trends to today's roiling crisis is that the foundation to provide quality care across the continuum are Medicaid outpatient mental health rates. Medicaid is the primary payer for children's mental health care, particularly for intensive service models. As the primary payer and the payer of last resort, when Medicaid does not cover the cost of care, we see the impacts that one would anticipate. Significant waiting times that delay urgently needed care, increasing needs, including increased acuity in clients. With increased symptoms and no clear path forward to access care, we have more families in crisis, more reliance on crisis systems, and as a result, we see boarding in hospital emergency departments, hoteling with counties, and putting mentally ill children in juvenile detention as, quote, the best option, as what our system does now. Past legislative bodies knew, as this report outlines today, that these are preventable heartaches for children, families, and communities. Minnesota has built a Medicaid benefit that includes incredibly effective service models, including several in-home intensive team-based services and a school-linked mental health design that has been the envy of many states. And without a Medicaid rate structure that works, we are left in a cycle of crisis, holding tightly to the very best ideas we can't implement because we can't hire and retain the staff to deliver the care. As the study outlines, rates can be complex, and the premise is clear. If we can't pay for the cost of care, we doom our system and, more importantly, our children and families to access care at the height of crisis, risking and prompting some of the greatest harm, trauma, and rupture of relationships. We, of course, could have chosen in past years to fix our rate system. Instead, we have the good fortune of a newly conducted rate study mapping out a way forward. This is indeed good news for children and families and for us all. I will note that we have been trying to fix our way out of this crisis at all levels of innovation with creative administrative simplification, reviewing ways to utilize interns, trainees, consider part-time staff, incentivized participation in the field through loan payment and other supports, mutual support for billing, staffing solutions, shared training opportunities, joint purchasing strategies, establishing the Mental Health Collaboration Hub to connect clinicians who can support applicable solutions for children boarding without access to treatment. All of these strategies have worked and have made a difference, and not one of these strategies can fix the over 40% gap between costs and reimbursement. As we've shared with you, we have all contributed to wonderful designs to our wider children and family service systems. Most recently, with hospital and wider mental health legislative network colleagues, we have composed the building blocks to confirm that we collectively know. We know what we need to build the system of the future based on effective and desirable service solutions, and none of it works until we can fix our rates.
Okay, please wrap up.
Yep. As community leaders, family members, and friends, you all know the stories of children's mental health crises at a profound and personal level. We truly have an incalculable level of heartbreak that this crisis has yielded for our children and families, for our professionals, for education, healthcare, youth justice systems, none of which are designed for mental health crisis, and for the painful loss of life. The good news is that we now know with the results of this rate study in 2024 that we can make the needed investments to intervene early, give families what they need to care for the children, to offer the skills, reassurance, and hope that with treatment, we can all be okay.
All right, thank you. Next up, Ashley Kimmel, and then on board is Jessica. Bruce, you're going to have to help me with the last name. Ashley Kimmel.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ashley Kimmel, and I'm the Assistant Director of Clinical Programs at Fernbrook Family Center. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to the rate study. Fernbrook provides mental health services in southern Minnesota in a 10-county region that includes urban, suburban, and highly rural areas. As part of my role at Fernbrook, I oversee our SchoolLink Behavioral Health Program that provides services to thousands of children and families across our service area by reducing financial barriers for families who are uninsured or underinsured with the goal of increasing access to mental health care. Taylor, a student at one of our schools, is the oldest child to a single mother with limited income. They were referred and recommended for services when his mother became concerned about physical aggression and anger. She was unable to access services in the community because she was unable to take time off of work. Through SchoolLink Behavioral Health, Taylor was able to receive the mental health services they needed to reduce their transportation barriers and decrease their aggression. Without SchoolLink Mental Health, Taylor would not have been able to access consistent care. Of the 93 schools we serve, 90% of our schools have waiting lists or do not have a provider at all. Our SchoolLink Behavioral Health program has 30 open positions. One of the positions has been open for 3 years with zero applicants. The underlying problem affecting the mental health system is a provider shortage. There are simply not enough providers because the access to mental health care is driven by a reimbursement structure that does not work. Schools are at a loss. Teachers are seeing students who are yelling, swearing, and hitting their peers. And they're also seeing kids who are sleeping in class, crying, and cutting their arms and legs. When we have a school-linked behavioral health provider in the building, teachers know that we're able to help them. But we can't help them if we don't have providers. No amount of grant funding can fix the foundation of that problem, which is our reimbursement rates. Most of my adult life has been dedicated to helping children. I completed 4 years of undergraduate school, 2 years of graduate school, and 4 years of supervised practice to become a licensed counselor. That's 10 years in total. In many other fields, this level of education and training results in a high-paying job. In the mental health field, with this level of education and training, many therapists are struggling to pay their bills and their student loans. Our staff working with the highest needs clients are making $18 an hour, despite having a bachelor's degree. This is a direct result of the very low reimbursement rates. We cannot ask providers to invest the time and resources it takes to do this work when local fast food restaurants are offering $22 as a starting salary. This is not sustainable. This is creating a workforce shortage in an already difficult workforce climate. It is causing providers to retire early, pushing providers into private practice that do not accept insurance, and is causing providers to close their doors entirely. Places like Fernbrook need to be able to hire people to do this work while making a livable wage. Over the last 2 years, I've also been assisting our intake department answering phone calls from caregivers who are looking to find services for their children. In that year, I spoke to Sally's dad after Sally tried to kill herself. And I spoke to Adam's mom after his brother died in a tragic car accident. And I spoke to Ava's grandmother after she was removed from the care of her parents. I spoke to each caregiver and listened as they cried, yelled, and begged us to see their children. And I had to turn them away because I didn't have enough providers. Fernbrook is not unique in this problem. Caregivers are calling 2 to 3 agencies just to be put on a year-long waiting list. And without access to the care they need, our kids are suffering. We know this work is impactful. We know what we do works. Recently, we had a 14-year-old client named Charlie who tried to kill herself 7 times. Out of fear for their child's safety, their caregiver was unable to leave them home alone before school, after school, or days when school was not in session. Because of this, Charlie's caregiver lost their job. With access to individual therapy, family therapy, and day treatment for 3 months, Charlie's now attending school regularly and has had 0 visits to the emergency department. And Charlie's caregiver is now able to find and keep a job. We need to support our providers so that we can continue to do this essential work. Our therapists are experiencing burnout at alarming rates. They are feeling pressure to take additional clients with similar stories to Taylor and Charlie. This is especially true for our staff in our SchoolLink Behavioral Health Program. In our largest school, there is 1 mental health provider for 400 students.
Please wrap it up.
Yep. Imagine telling a client who recently lost a parent that we have a waiting list and cannot help them. Providers are taking extra clients, working overtime, and doing everything in their power to provide services to as many clients as possible. And it's becoming too much for many of them. We cannot fix the mental health system without fixing the rates. The only thing that matters is treating our kids and families, but we can't do that because there's not enough of us. It is true that the need for mental health care has increased and the mental health crisis is at an all-time high. We have the opportunity to strengthen the foundation of our mental health system by adopting the recommendation for a new rate structure. The new rate structure acknowledges the years of education, training, and supervision required to do this work. It allows agencies to retain high-quality staff by offering livable wages, and it provides children with the opportunity to access mental health care when their symptoms first begin with limited wait times. We need your support in implementing the rate recommendations to build a sustainable mental health system to support generations to come. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you. You're going to have to help me with the last name. Brisbois, is that correct?
Brisbois, yes.
Okay. And then after that will be Jenny Palin. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Frederick and committee members. My name is Jessica Brisbois. I am the manager of acute mental health services at Children's Minnesota. I appreciate you having me here today to share about the challenges we are facing in meeting the mental health needs of Minnesota kids. There is a lack of mental health services in our state, and children are waiting for months to access care, too often utilizing the emergency department as a last resort. In 2018, about 1,700 visits to Children's Minnesota emergency departments were for a mental health concern. In 2022, that number increased to 2,500. And in 2023, that number increased to even more to 3,300. And in the first 10 months of 2023, over 200 kids collectively spent almost 1,500 days stuck at Children's Minnesota because the appropriate treatment center was not available to them. The parents and guardians of these children have often recognized their child's need for support and worked diligently to try to get them care, but have run into barriers accessing outpatient services, including long wait lists. While waiting, their child's mental health gets worse, and families find themselves desperately seeking a solution, which is what brings them to the emergency department. We do our best to stabilize these children while they're with us, but when they're discharged, they are often still on those wait lists and won't have guaranteed access to support when they return home. This increases the risk of them returning to the emergency department in crisis again in the future. As a provider, I know that if these kids had access to outpatient mental health services, many of these crises could be avoided. This is why increasing Medicaid rates is vital to addressing the current challenges facing children in our state. Nearly half of our patients receiving mental health services rely on Medicaid. Wait times for outpatient mental health care range from 2 months to 2 years, depending on what the child needs. Due to challenges with hiring staff and increasing demand for care, most of our outpatient services are only available to current Children's Minnesota patients, and even then, we do not have capacity to provide care for every child who needs it. Currently, Medicaid rates for these services are paid well below the cost of providing care. Across all of our outpatient mental health services, we are reimbursed for less than half of our costs. And because costs continue to rise, that level of reimbursement is getting worse. While the DHS study is focused on outpatient rates, I'd be remiss if I didn't note that this trend is the same for the inpatient services we provide. The current rates are unsustainable, and on average, we operate these vital services at a loss, severely limiting our ability to recruit and retain the staff needed to meet the growing needs of our patients and their families. One of the biggest impacts we can have on the mental health crisis is investing in outpatient care. When you invest in outpatient care, it decreases the pressure on the rest of the system, including emergency departments, inpatient units, and other more acute services. My colleagues and I are working tirelessly to support patients and families, and we need the legislature to support us by making these investments now. Thank you to the Department of Human Services for sharing these recommendations today, and thank you, committee members, for your time.
Thank you. Up next is Jenny Palin, and then after that will be Lewis Ziedner.
Thank you, Chair Frederick and members of the committee. My name is Jenny Palin. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs, or MACMAP. We are a state association representing our community mental health centers, community mental health clinics, and several community mental health and SUD programs across the state. Thank you for holding this hearing and reviewing the recommendations from this rate study report. Similar to the experiences of our partners that have just testified and will be testifying, our community mental health centers, clinics, and programs are also experiencing some severe shortages and risks in sustaining our services. They are closing programs or significantly decreasing the sizes of their services. We are seeing increasingly long waiting lists and periods of time that clients are on those waiting lists, sometimes more than 2 months at a time, because we have such extreme provider shortages and unfilled staff positions. Much of this is due to the competitive market salaries that our staff are seeing across other markets going up 30 to 40%, while our public program reimbursements have remained relatively flat. You've been hearing that quite a bit. I just wanted to reiterate that this is also something that our community mental health services and programs are experiencing. We are striving to keep up with this need for care and while being reflective and responsive to the individuals, families, and communities that we serve. And we have been working with you all in the legislature and the department over many bills and several different rate studies in partnership trying to solve this problem over many years. We're grateful for the work that you all in the legislature and the department did to pass the 3% rate increase to our mental health services last year. And we know that a lot of that outcome was influenced by the anticipation of this rate study that we are reviewing today. And so we are really very happy to see the recommendations and are hoping to have some more conversations around supporting how to move those forward. And to that, I want to note that our provider community in the mental health space has been in some very good conversations with DHS, and we are introducing some legislation this year using some of the department's technical assistance in guiding us to include several of the report's recommendations in some legislation this year. including aligning our RBRVS system to 100% of the Medicare fee schedule, addressing our mental health and SUD services who are not part of Medicare by moving those into a market-based system, cost system, increasing our residential SUD services, and streamlining and increasing our behavioral health home rates. The bill that we are working on as it stands today has some additional proposals as well, including paying for all of our services at the same rate when they are provided by any licensed professional, and not distinguishing the difference between doctoral level or master's level education if the service provided is the same service within our program sector. Looking at bonus structures for incentivizing that we are making sure our underserved and professional shortage areas are getting the service access that they need across the state. Increasing our hospital rebasing adjuster for inpatient behavioral health services, and ensuring that these rate changes are making it down to the providers themselves when we are talking about some of the managed care programs that our providers may be working under. We also do recognize that we are in a tight budget environment this year, and that this work will need to be scaled in implementation. And we are very hopeful for future conversations around how we can look at moving parts of this critical work forward this year. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next will be Lewis Edner, and on after that will be Brandon George. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Lou Zeidner. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Meridian Behavioral Health. We have 11 residential SUD or substance use disorder treatment centers and 8 outpatient. We represent 635 beds across the state, about 17% of the capacity of the state to treat substance use. The stagnant reimbursement and escalating operational costs are threatening the viability of our programs. We're urging immediate legislative action to implement the rates outlined in the DHS rate study to ensure sustainability of essential SUD services for the highly vulnerable population needing medical assistance. In the last year, the number of actively licensed SUD facilities in Minnesota has decreased by 8% during a time when the need is described as at crisis levels. The drop does not include the number of facilities, including some of our own, that operate below licensed capacity because of staffing and related issues. According to Dane's data, about 76% of individuals that received SUD treatment in the state did so using state funding, county or state funding. This highlights the importance of state funding and the viability of the SUD care system. Wages in healthcare have increased 20% since 2019 and 45% since 2009, when the rates were last adjusted. Additionally, the care needs of patients have continually increased as the number of patients with mental health disorders who also suffer from SUD has increased, and the use of drugs like fentanyl, this requires more advanced training and at a higher cost. Reduction in access to care through the closure of facilities impact public health and contribute to the increase in overdoses and related deaths. Overdose deaths in Minnesota have increased by 338% since 2010 and 135% since 2019. The National Institute on Drug Abuse estimates that for every dollar invested in treatment, there is a savings of over $12 from reduced crime, criminal justice, and health care costs. Minnesota's medical assistance reimbursement rates for residential SUD are significantly lower than border states. For example, the rates for ASAM 3.5 level care are 146% below those in North Dakota. Iowa recently increased rates by 96% to respond to some of these same challenges.
Please wrap it up.
I'm sorry?
Please wrap it up.
I implore the committee to consider the immediate implementation of rates proposed by the DHS rate study. This action is not just a matter of financial necessity for SUD facilities. It's a matter of public health and safety for the people of Minnesota. I appreciate your attention to this critical issue and look forward to your support in making the necessary changes to sustain SUD care in our state. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Brandon George, and then after that will be Brian Zervis.
Thank you, Chair Frederick and members of the committee. First of all, I just want to applaud everybody for taking on this difficult issue. It's non-budget year, and you guys have to weigh the needs and financial impact of an entire state, not just this. My name is Brandon George. I'm a Vice President of Ascension Recovery Services. We help start and operate behavioral health facilities, specifically on the SUD and mental health side. We work in 35 states, Minnesota being one of them. And some insight that was just mentioned to what peers are doing in other states. Illinois just raised their price, or their Medicaid rates by 46%, Iowa 96%. And several in line with that over the last couple years. I don't want to repeat what other speakers said, but I do want to note that this is not rhetoric. It is a dire situation, and people are beginning to speak with their actions. The number of providers are leaving in a material fashion. Like, the numbers are dropping significantly. And the other side of that is nobody is coming in. We've got investor groups, et cetera, that look at Minnesota. They like it because the low number of providers. And immediately when they figure out the rates are, they don't come to Minnesota. I've got two people that are bringing facilities in right now. And the only way to make it work is to do commercial facilities and not actually serve the people in the most need, because they can't even get bank funding based on the financial model of the Medicaid rates. They couldn't get approved for building and startup costs because of that. The cost is going to be high. There's no doubt about that. I don't envy the decision you guys have to make, but the cost of not doing anything is much, much higher based on where it's going to impact criminal justice system, emergency departments, et cetera. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And lastly, we have Brian Zervis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Brian Zervis. I'm the executive director of MARCH, the Minnesota Association of Resources for Recovery and Chemical Health. We're a statewide trade association for substance disorder programs and professionals. In short, I'll keep it brief. We've submitted a letter. There's lots of data and details contained in our letter. In short, what we're looking for, our mantra is rates fast, change slow, help now. We conducted a survey of our membership last spring, and the responses regarding rates generally can be bucketed into three categories. Programs are limiting services to their clients. They're limiting workforce reimbursement for their employees, increased workload for their employees. And the third option is closure or scaling down. So it is, I think we're at a critical point in the state right now. I think that what's needed is both immediate funding for substance disorder programs as well as long-term structural changes that are incorporated in the rate methodology. We do think the rates that the vendor identified do an accurate reflection of the true cost of delivering services at the various ASAM levels. But I think the numbers on slides 23 and 24 are really stark. When you average out the net increase, it's just under 65% increase across all SUD service lines. So one thing we would ask the legislature to consider is, going back to last session, the 3% rate increase and automatic inflation adjustment, SUD was carved out of that rate increase. So from an immediate fix, that would be one thing that would provide a little ray of hope to SUD providers, understanding that long-term structural rate increases may need to happen in the 2025 legislative session. With that, I'll conclude. Thank you for the time and opportunity.
All right, thank you. I want to give a thank you to all the members that were able to join us today. I want to thank everyone that came here to testify. We went a little over time, but I wanted to make sure that we gave everybody the opportunity to testify. So I will ask if there are any members here who have any follow-up questions or comments. Seeing none, we have no further business in front. What? Oh, actually, Representative Baker.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. And, you know, first of all, this is a fabulous hearing. I'm glad we're doing this. And it shows we really missed the boat on this issue. The testimony is moving. We are losing providers left and right. And I'm concerned that we're midway through this budget and really the two-year biennium, and we still have a lot of money that we could actually reallocate if we want to really take a leadership role on this. But to kind of go through the mental health support and kind of go through what we just heard and to say that this is not a priority for all of us, because everybody in this room cares deeply about this issue. that we should try to reallocate $1.5 billion sitting aside for paid family medical leave that we could maybe delay a little bit and use some of that to fix this and help this reimbursements out right now. I don't think we can wait until 2025. You know, my work in ORAC and substance use disorder, and we're just trying to stand up these treatment centers and the outpatient, inpatient, and yet we're losing them because we aren't paying them the reimbursements to the cost of their services. So I implore the members and the committee chairs and all of the folks that we have lots of money that we just spent in probably areas that we should maybe have moved some over here, because this industry missed out. And I was getting calls as soon as session ended last year, like, how could we have gotten missed? I just wanted to just say, number one, thank you for having this hearing. This is super important for our work. I don't know what could be almost a higher priority of how we could have missed on this. And we need to adjust it because it's halftime in our 2-year budget. We can still make some adjustments to the team. And I hope that we really get serious about this. And I'm looking forward to working with everybody. But I can't thank the testifiers enough. It is really painful out there, and we have to do something, and I don't think we can wait another year. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to speak to that. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Chair Knorr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank DHS staff for the presentation, also everyone who testified. I just wanted to make sure that we set the expectation right. As you all know, I think we are facing a structural deficit in terms of the budget process. We will do everything in our ability and power to make sure that we increase rates. But I just wanted to caution, there's no expectation of having a budget during this session. So I just wanted to make sure everybody's aware of. We wanted you to be, to make sure that the expectation that we are setting right now is to say we will do our best. But at this point, I think I don't want to disappoint anybody. We don't have any budget capacity to do the rate increases that were reflected in the study, but we'll keep on working together. So thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I wasn't going to say anything. This is not my committee. I work in this industry. I work with these providers every day. And for us to sit here and have this, have this hearing, which I think is important, these rates are vital. There's all kinds of things that we can do. Preventative, we can work on scholarships, we can work on those things. But these are the basis of their business models. I mean, they're already so underpaid. I mean, we're looking at hoping to get to Medicare rates. I think Representative Baker is right. We need to come around this issue. We're not going to have providers. I have one school-based provider that dropped 23 schools in Hennepin County solely because of the rates. And I want to be honest with providers, too. And I'm going to work hard. I'll work with anybody that will try to find some money that we can reappropriate to these guys, because they're going to be gone. And I'll be done. But I don't mean to be disrespectful at all. But this is the most important thing that we can do in the legislature, in my opinion.
Thank you, Representative Nadeau. I'll just say that I think everyone here has the interests of all Minnesotans at heart, and however we can get there. We want to do as much as we possibly can this next legislative year, or this year. So with that, I will say that our next hearing will likely be during the 2024 legislative session. With that, we are adjourned.